here in a timely fashion. Well, I see one young lady that's probably going to get in a perfect attendance bonus, and I see another one, I think, who is getting in a perfect attendance bonus, and I think I see two more that I'm pretty sure are getting perfect attendance bonuses, so that's good. And Dylan's been to most, not all. All right. Six of you. So I did send a message. I think 13 people in the class have submitted papers. But that means four have not. So I didn't want to call out anybody individually. But just know that if you haven't submitted the papers yet, the clock is ticking. And every single day that goes by, you lose more points. And then eventually you're going to run out of points to lose. So if you haven't done it yet, do it. If you've already submitted it, thank you. I appreciate it. As I said in the message, I'm going to start grading them probably tonight. And what I do is first in line, first in right. So I get an email for every time a paper is submitted. And I'll keep my email box open and I'll bounce between my classes in order that they're received. So when I get to your paper, I will reply. And what I will do is I will tell you exactly what you did wrong. Because that's what I'm grading you on, following directions. I'll explain everything so you fully understand it. And I'll give you some advice on basically next time you write a paper, how to improve. I will also calculate what you need on the final exam to keep whatever your current average is. Because right now you can figure out your average. Take your first three exams, divide by three. That's easy. But the moment I factor the paper in, it's going to screw up math. Because the exams are 15% each, but the paper's 20. So I will do the math for you. I will tell you what you need to get on that hard copy paper exam that you're going to have to take. That is worth 35% of your grade to keep your average what it is, possibly go up one letter grade, or what happens when you get below. So it will all be spelled out. And my plan is to get them all done by Thursday. So I know you guys have the exam on the Tuesday, May 6th, I believe. So by the time you walk in here, you should know exactly what you need to do on that piece of paper to get whatever grade you're looking for. Yeah, I think that's it. Any of you have any questions for me at this time? All right, well, let's get into this stuff because we have two classes left. And then you'll have all you need in terms of information and you can start studying for the final. Russian Revolution. Russia, as we said, had the largest army, but it was not ready for the war that would result. We know that even though they were big, they were weak. They lost to the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War. There also was a revolution in 1905, which I'm going to talk to you about a little bit in a few minutes. But by 1914, when Tsar Nicholas II decides we're going to get into the war because Austria is going to attack Serbia, it was the dumbest decision he made. Now, we know the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, was kind of a bully, I guess we could say. Strong-headed, brash, emotional. Nicholas, from what I've read about him, he was a good, decent man that should not have been ruler. If he would have just been a blacksmith, a carpenter, or whatever, he would have been a loving husband, he would have been a doting father, but he was not fit to be basically the emperor of this empire. So he took his nation into the war, even though everything was going against them. Not enough guns for their troops. Bad leadership. No medical capability. And their military, as it's getting mowed down, had to be refilled by taking the peasants. The peasants who are the ones responsible for the food. So eventually, when you lose millions of your people, you lose the ability to feed the civilian population.
And when that occurs, people get hangry. Now, the problems that sparked the revolution were not developed in 1914. Heck, it wasn't even developed during the reign of Nicholas II. It goes all the way back hundreds of years. The biggest reason was that Russia was like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was a supranationalist empire. Meaning, one racial group ruled over ethnic minorities. In 1914, in this vast domain that was the largest land-based empire ever stitched together, which literally stretched from Europe all the way to almost Alaska, only 45% of the population were what we could call Russian. The rest were hundreds of ethnic minority groups. Clans, tribes, you name it. There were over 20 languages spoken amongst the population. There were over 16 different major religions practiced by the people of the empire. And 89% of the population were rural peasants. There were few cities, there were even fewer factories. Literally, life in 1914 was, for the vast majority of Russians, the same as it was for their great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. But yet, they're jumping into this war of social Darwinism, 19th century racism, nationalism. They should not have done it. Because there was nationalism being viewed in Russia by all the minorities that wanted their independence. Again, no offense to the Rus people, the Rus. But if I was a different racial group, I wouldn't want to be owned or controlled by somebody else. I would want my own country, particularly if this is my homeland. Because don't forget, Russia grew through conquest. How do they keep it together? Please state. There were no police like we think of police. What there were soldiers. So, whenever the ethnic minorities protested, demanded some type of right or protection, they weren't met with by reporters or lawyers or politicians. No, the soldiers marched out. And if you did not disperse, you'd be shot. You could be seized, abducted, put on a train and shipped out to Siberia, where they had gulags. Basically labor camps. If you went out there, the whole purpose was for you to die. You would be worked to death. So, you have this tightly controlled system aimed at keeping everybody in their place. But then you have Tsar Nicholas II. Decent man. But that's about it. It was the Tsar's fault that the Russo-Japanese War occurred. And then while Russia's fighting the Japanese, which we've already talked about, a revolution actually breaks out in his own country. This is known as the 1905 Revolution. And what sparked the revolution was an event known as Bloody Sunday. Awful, 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 awful event. For decades, there had been a group of intellectuals known as the intelligentsia. And these intelligentsia were calling for things like due process of law, right of free speech, right of personal property. You know, those basic things that we as Americans completely take for granted. And they called upon the Tsar to implement some reforms to try to protect the people, not to control the people. Well, on a Sunday, I believe it was in March, 1905, might have been February, don't remember. There was a situation where the food supply was running low because the bulk of it was being shipped out to Manchuria because the Russian army was fighting against the Japanese. There were factory workers that were forced to work 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts, to make bullets if they could, or boots, or whatever the soldiers needed. They were literally being worked to death. So on this Sunday, a group of factory workers, led by a priest, went to the Tsar's palace in St. Petersburg to pray that the Tsar give them a half a day on Sunday, so at least they could go to church. But guess what? The Tsar was not home. As luck would have it, the Tsar was out on a hunting trip. But the Tsarina and the Tsar's children were in the palace. By the way, there were no cell phones either. So the guards of the palace see this mob coming out. They don't know what they're doing. So what do you think they did?
You know.
They started opening fire. This would lead to a general uprising in the city. And as word spread in a couple of the other Russian cities, there would be similar uprisings. Look it, the Tsar's system is so abusive, we can't even pray to God. Or we'll get shot. Well, the revolution was short-lived, because in 1905, the army stayed on the side of the Tsar. So it was crushed. Now, if the Tsar was smart, he would have met with the leaders. He would have talked to them and figure out something to make the people's lives better. Again, I'm a taskmaster, I'll admit it. I actually want people to do things when I ask them to do it. But the idea of giving someone time off so they can go to church with their families, I could be okay with that. But what does the Tsar do? He increases the police state. He creates a special secret police force that begins going through the towns and the cities looking for the leaders of this revolution so that way they can be seized, possibly shot, possibly shipped out to the gulags. Had a chance, but he missed it. Questions? Now, as bad as that was, there were other things that were making it worse. You ever have one of those days where you like you do something wrong, and that's how the day starts off? So, like, you start off, you get out of bed, and you smash your toe on the bed. And then you're like, oh, my toe, my toe, my toe. Then you go in and you take a shower or whatever, and you go to brush your teeth. And bam, you use your toothbrush and you jam it into your gums. And that gets you. And then you go and you put your favorite shirt on and it has a hole in the armpit. It's like it's just everything. Damn, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Well, that's essentially what happened in Russia. You have poor people, minorities, held together through violence. Plus, those things we talked about already. Being outmaneuvered by Austria, being embarrassed on the world stage, being beaten by Japan, being blocked by their so-called allies, Britain and France. That made a lot of people question, what is our government doing? Plus, economically speaking, this was the most lopsided society ever in the modern world. 3% of the population, just 3%, controlled 95% of the nation's wealth. The wealth of the wealthy is beyond opulence. But when 3% have 95% of every dollar, quarter, nickel, dime, penny, and 97% has 5%, I think that works. Oh, and by the way, because the 3% were nobles, they didn't really pay any taxes. As if that wasn't bad enough, we've already talked about how they were not prepared to go for the war. Stupidest decision they made. Stupidest decision they made. And last but not least, the realities once the war began. That catch 22. They didn't have enough guns, enough bullets, so they had to do those massive wave attacks, which meant more death, which meant you had to take more of the peasants from the fields, send them to the battlefield to die, which means food production lows, and you're still not winning the war. Questions? Yes?
Does Dr. Zhivago come close to the reality of what
yes.
really happened?
Yeah, it was bad. It was real bad.
Because they made it seem like it's a social issue, but it was more, there was no food.
It was really complicated, yeah.
Okay.
And this is going to sound crazy, but it is what it is. As bad as you could argue things were in the United States before the Civil War, because that's really the worst period in our history,
yeah.
Doesn't even come close to this.
Really?
Doesn't even come close. Again, in Russia, if you were a peasant, you were basically a slave. So that meant 89% of the population were slaves. So, to your point, by 1916, the home front completely collapses. There's no food. There's no money. There's only hunger. And what does the Tsar do to ease the pains of the people? Nothing. Does nothing to boost morale. Now, by the way, and I only know this because ironically, when you guys leave, I keep teaching a class on it, from the Vietnam War. 1968, when Richard Nixon won the presidency, he wanted to end the war in Vietnam. He was done with it. And he worked to end the war in Vietnam, but it just took a couple of years because the North Vietnamese refused to negotiate. But while this was going on, Nixon constantly tried doing things to prevent our country from getting out of control. Were there protests? Yes. Were there large protests? Yes. But when you actually look at the numbers, the people protesting the Vietnam War were 1 or 2 or 3% of the population. Poll after poll after poll said that there was a silent majority that agreed with what Nixon was doing. They just weren't out on the streets protesting because the silent majority are usually the normal people that have to wake up in the morning and go to work and do jobs and pay their bills.
Yeah.
But what did Nixon do to deal with the young college students that were protesting? Well, one of the biggest things did is he pushed for the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age. Because one of the biggest justifiable complaints that the young people had was like, I can be drafted to go to war and die, but I can't vote. Nixon did other things. He met with leaders. He tried talking with them. But of course, then he got himself into a little bit of trouble, and the whole Watergate thing happened. Well, that's history. But that's a good example of a president, a leader, dealing with a war that there were people in society that were against, but he managed to manage it all the way until the war came to an end. If the Tsar would have done something, lowered taxes, tried getting more grain, lowering the working hours, give them a day off, the revolution would not have occurred. But he did nothing. Why? He had no idea what was going on. Proof. When the revolution erupted, the first day, the first protest took place on our calendar on March 8th. FYI, on the Russian calendar, it was February 23rd. The protest began when the factory workers were fed up with the fact that they were not getting paid. So, what do the factory workers do? They walk off the job. And they go into the streets. The problem was, when the workers walked out, they went to join their wives in the food lines. Because the Tsar's government had been giving out daily food rations. But the catch is, first in line, first in right. Very typically, the food was gone in a half hour. So you could spend the whole day there, and it would be gone before you even got up and maybe moved a few spaces down the line. So now suddenly you've got these angry workers that haven't gotten paid, and they begin getting in the lines, and they begin pushing and shoving. It was a spontaneous event. It wasn't planned. There were no leaders. It's just when the first people walked off the first factory floor, word spread. Hey, the guy in Acme Factory is walking off. Why don't we walk off too? And before you know it, the whole capital of St. Petersburg, all the workers of all the jobs are on the streets.
Men, women, children, all angry.
But here is the thing. When this erupted, because of what had been happening on the war front, the soldiers joined the strikers. Because you know what the soldiers were thinking? I'm not going to shoot a woman because she can't get food for her baby. I'm not going to shoot a guy who's angry because he hasn't gotten paid in 2 months. Heck! I don't want to get shot. What's going to happen if they send my unit to the front? It was spontaneous, it was leaderless, but there were so many problems, it exploded like a volcano. Now here is the most amazing thing. Word gets sent to the Tsar. But it took 4 days for the message to get to him. Because Nikki was out on the front. And he was doing photo ops. But the irony was, they would only let him go to the units that pledged their full loyalty to the Tsar. Because by this point, there were units that were mutinying. So they were staged political events. He gets a message from the head of the Duma. No spoilers. He gets the head of the leader of the Duma, which is like their parliament. man by the name of Mikhail Rodzinenko. And he quickly sends word to the Tsar. He says, the capital is in chaos. The government is unable to act. The transport service is broken down. The food and fuel supplies are completely disorganized. There's wild shooting on the streets. There's an urgent need of strong government. There must be no delay. Hesitation is fatal. The Tsar gets the message. He never responds. The next day, he sends a communication to his wife, the Tsarina. And he claims, and I quote, again, that fat belly Rodzinenko has written me a load of nonsense, which I won't even bother to answer. The next day, a communication comes from the Tsarina, who is nowhere near downtown. She has no idea what's going on. But she sends word to the Tsar that her children, including the Tsar's heir, young Alexei, have come down with the measles. So what does the Tsar do? He stops his little propaganda photo op tour, gets on a train, and orders to race back to the palace so he can be with his kids. Well, like I said, there were many units that were mutinying. A bunch of units got word that the Tsar's train was racing down the train line. And what did they do? Well, at one of the points where there's a spur, they diverted the train and had it go down a dead end. And then once the train came to a stop, the mutinous soldiers came out, surrounded the train, and threatened to shoot the Tsar dead unless he gives up power. So the generals that were on the train with the Tsar says, Your Majesty, you might want to abdicate. The Tsar originally did not want to because he wanted to preserve the Romanov dynasty. Instead, what he wanted to do is to give the throne to his brother Mikhail. But Mikhail, who was on the train, tells his brother, I don't want it. So in the end, the Tsar gives up power. Realizing the game was over. Now, his family, the Romanovs, had been ruling Russia for 300 years. And with no declared heir, the monarchy was dead. FYI. The soldiers would allow Nicholas to return back to the palace. He would then be allowed to gather the Tsarina and his children, his four beautiful daughters, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, Anastasia, and of course, young Alexei. They would go into one of their winter homes, way away from the city, and they were basically placed under house arrest. Nicholas attempted to contact his cousin, King George V of England, and asked if he could receive asylum in Britain. Well, the problem was, is by 1917, conditions in England were also deteriorating. And England was afraid of a socialist revolution. Because it wasn't as bad as it was in Russia, but it wasn't good either. So George V actually told his cousin, no. Remember, England was Russia's ally. So then the Tsar contacts France and asks France for asylum. Well, guess what's going on in France? We already talked about what's going on in the Western Front. The French army was on the verge of mutiny. French government had no idea what was going to happen. They figured they were going to lose. So the French basically say, we don't have the resources to get here. So what happens to the Tsar and his family? He remains trapped in Russia. Questions? All right. Well, now what? We now have no government. Well, into the void would jump two sources of power. One would be made up of those people on strikes. The soldiers and the workers would form councils, for which the Russian word is Soviet. The leading council was in Petrograd, which is the Russian way of saying St. Petersburg. This group would be seated with Mensheviks. Not that you need to remember that, because that was a minority group. But the Mensheviks were the socialists. But they were the more moderate socialists. So they wanted to have a government similar to what the government was in France at the start of the revolution. So they wanted like the Third Republic. They wanted like a constitution, they wanted to have an elective government, and they wanted like social protections. Government assistance, subsidized housing, subsidized health, price controls, and all the rest. They were at the core of this new government body. But interestingly enough, within their ranks was none other than a man, if you know history, by the name of Leon Trotsky, who was preparing the Petrograd Soviet for the return of his colleague. So obviously, the Petrograd Soviet was interested only in the interests of the workers and the soldiers. Well, then you had the remnants of the national government, the Duma. They would organize a temporary government. And the easiest way just to remember it is you just call them a provisional government. What they planned on doing was trying to figure out some type of new government. So maybe we have to have a constitution, maybe we want to do something, you know, kind of like maybe in America, or maybe we want to kind of have what England has, maybe we'll do a constitutional monarchy. You know, they just didn't know. But these were the people that had been in government, so they just kind of stayed in government. The key leader was Alexander Kerensky. He himself was a very moderate socialist, more moderate than the Mensheviks. But I guess you could say he was kind of like a figure like maybe Bill Clinton was, to give you a good analogy. If you know anything about the politics of Bill Clinton. Scandals, we're not including the scandals, just when Clinton was president. All right. Now here's the thing. You have the group that's claiming to be the government because they kind of were the government before, and then you have the people. Who wins? Who is going to get the support of the masses? Well, both tried. Yes. What? Go all the way back? That's where I ended up.
Yeah, I got it all. It's just the old one. I'm missing something.
I might have changed it if you're using the online one.
No, I'm not using it. I'm just typing in everyone. It's the one before that one.
I gotta go all the way back?
My bad. You don't want to, it's okay.
Can we do it after class?
Yeah,
alright. All right. I was in a groove. Where was I going? Oh, all right. So you have both of these governments, and they're claiming to represent Russia. But in order to represent Russia, they have to get massive support. And both groups tried basically competing to get the support of the people. Now, ironically, in many ways, both had the same agenda. Both called for freedom. Both talked about liberty. Both talked about rights. Both talked about government assistance. But the problem is a problem that probably doesn't happen here because campus is too small and too isolated. So I will give you a story that I experienced when I was your age. And I was an undergrad at the zoo, the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. You know where I'm going. So I came from a small town. My graduating class was about 80. Might have been 75, I don't remember. But I go to college, UMass. In my freshman year, I'm taking introductory classes in lecture halls that have hundreds of people in it. I had no chance of ever talking to my professors. I don't even think I was considered to be a number. If I did need help, I would have to go to the teaching assistant if the teaching assistant had time to even answer my calls. By the way, there was no emails, so you pretty much had to show up and do things in person. Well, I was there, and I was just lost. And a lot of people, when they go to those big colleges, are lost. Because what happens is you come from your small town, and you're used to the way life was. And then suddenly, there's no mom and dad. There's no, well, the neighbors know who I am, so I better behave myself. Oop, some of the cops in town know I am, so I gotta behave myself. Instead, you're just in this sea of people that want to do nothing but take advantage of the fact that they're on their own and live life and party and do stupid things. Well, this freedom given to people that had didn't even understand what the word was. Because if they looked at someone the wrong way, they could be shot. They could be put on a train and shipped to the gulag. Now suddenly they're able to do what they want. It would result in anarchy, in chaos. So much so. The trolley cars stopped working. Like every couple of days, the electricity would go off. There was some running water, but that was not reliable. Food deliveries came and went. I mean, it was just chaos. It was like gangs were running the city. And then over the next several months, this chaos just got worse and worse and worse. Why? There was no control. By the way, before I go on, by the way, there's still a war going on. If you ever have the ability to look at an analysis of 1917 on the Eastern Front, Germany conquered more territory in just a few months than they had in the 2 years prior. There was virtually no resistance. Plus, it was a political free-for-all. Soon, all the ethnic minorities, all the places that had been conquered, basically been saying there's no national government. And one by one, they started declaring their independence. People or places like Georgia and Uzbekistan and the Ukraine and Belarus, they started just basically breaking away. So the country's literally falling apart. There's a free-for-all everywhere. Oh, and the Germans are coming. And then the provisional government proverbially shot itself in the foot. They made two critical mistakes. The first mistake was they intentionally removed the czarist government. police state. They started promising open trials, due process, and all the rest. That's directly the reason why things snowballed out of control. Because I hate to say it, but if your population is striking on the streets and you don't do anything to bring order, you're going to lose. You're going to lose the city. And then as you lose the city, then you're going to lose the country around it. And then eventually it's going to get into the next city and it's going to spread like a virus. And that's what happened. And the second mistake, they stayed in the war. They gambled, and they gambled wrong. The Allies had been making promises of spoils. Because, by the way, that's the way prior to, well, I guess Korea, that's the way wars ended. The winner gets the spoils. So the provisional government was staying in because the French said, look, if you just stay in the war, we're going to beat the Germans. And when we beat the Germans, we'll give you all of Poland. You can carve up Austria-Hungary. You can get a chunk of the Balkans. And we'll give you money. We'll give you food. So the provisional government just like, well, if we drop out, we're dead. But if we stay in and somehow the war ends quickly, then maybe we can start fixing things. Fortunately, as you know, the war goes on for another year. So when the people suddenly realized the provisional government was going to keep fighting, our sons were going to keep dying, there was no hope of change. They switched sides and they started supporting the Soviets. Questions?
Survival of the fittest.
By summer of 1917, over 2 million soldiers would desert, would literally walk off the front. And they would bring their anger and their frustration back to their villages, in the towns. And then word spread what was going on in the war and how the war was under control continued to spread. And then if that wasn't bad enough, into the chaos comes none other than Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, who is known to the world as Lenin, the leader of the Bolshevists. The person who called for violent revolution. He would return to Moscow. Sorry, not Moscow. St. Petersburg. And he would penetrate into the Soviets with his aides. And what did Lenin want? Called for the creation of a dictatorship of the proletariat. That he and his fellow Bolshevists would be given absolute power, and then they would destroy all of the industrial and capitalistic and monarchical elements in Russia. Equalize society. And pave the way from a transition from socialism to communism. And how would he do it? By killing anyone who stood in his way.
One of the real differences between socialism and communism.
Well, the obvious is communism is not achievable. Because communism calls for a classless society.
Okay.
You can't have a classless society. You always need some type of government leadership. So socialism is a system where one party has all the power. But what they do is they use that propaganda. Oh, we're communists, meaning we're all equals. But did you ever read what life was like, you know, when Stalin was in power? He had more wealth than the Tsar's nobles had. And their people were still hungry and poor. All right. So now we have, oh, does anyone know anything about how Lenin got to St. Petersburg? I know weird things. He fled Russia after the 1905 revolution. He would actually spend some years in the city of Munich, which is the capital of Bavaria in Germany. And he lived in the same neighborhood who just a few years later would be inhabited by none other than Adolf Hitler. He, when the World War erupted, fled because the Kaiser's government began cracking down on socialists. So he ended up going to Switzerland. But the Germans knew where he was. So in 1917, when the Tsar is toppled, and you have this provisional government that doesn't look what they're doing, Germany tracks him down. And says, look, I know you're a socialist and you're calling for this revolution. How about we put you on a train? Send you back to Russia. So he would be put on a German train and he would be transported from Switzerland all the way through Germany, all the way through the Eastern Front. Because he was going to be the secret weapon to knock Russia out of the war. All right. As if that wasn't bad enough, this right here was pretty much the end of the provisional government. Due to the manipulations and instigations of Lenin and the Bolshevists, things really started getting out of complete control. Kerensky contacts the man who had been anointed by the provisional government as commander-in-chief of the Russian army, Lavra Kornilov. Kornilov was a nationalist. He was a patriot. He was dedicated to Russia. And he was trying to stop the German advance. Kerensky contacts him and says, look, there's this Lenin guy now in St. Petersburg, and the Soviets are getting out of control, and it looks like the provisional government's going to lose the capital. So can you get a group of loyal soldiers and help us crush the Soviets? Kornilov says yes. His armies were highly equipped and highly loyal to him. So he had a secret plan in which he would march to St. Petersburg and use his forces to basically restore law and order. Unfortunately, rumors started spreading, instigated probably by Trotsky, that what Kornilov was doing was he was going to march on the capital and name himself initially as a dictator and then eventually put the crown of the Tsar on his own head and thus reestablish the monarchy. Which, by the way, there is no evidence that that was even an inkling of an idea in his head. So he gathers his troops, he begins marching to crush the Bolshevists. Rumors spread. And then as he starts getting close to the city and all of the rumors spread, members of the provisional government betray Kerensky and Kornilov. Because what does Kerensky not do? He doesn't tell him the plan. Jesus. So what does the provisional government do? Well, they reach out to the Soviets and they're like, look, we're neither of us are going to be able to solve this problem unless, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they reach out to the Soviets. They convince them to shut off the water, shut off the electricity, block the streets, prevent the army from coming in, which they do. And then, as if matters weren't bad enough, the bulk of Cornelius' army starts hearing the propaganda and the lies, and they switch sides. They join with the Soviets too. Kornilov would resign as commander-in-chief. He would be arrested and he would be imprisoned. But now, without their last capable general, without their last loyal armies, there is no more provisional government. And in the chaos, the Bolshevists take full control, starting with St. Petersburg, and then Moscow, and then city after city after city after city. And if you have no soldiers, and you don't have the loyalty of the people, you give up. One by one, the members of the provisional government secretly in the middle of the night snuck out of the capital and just kind of disappeared. Some would spearhead the White Russian movement during the Russian Civil War. Some would leave the country. But now, there is no provisional government. All that's left are the Soviets. And in comes the predicted seizure of power by Lenin and company. On November 7th, or October 24th, on the Russian calendar, under Bolshevist propaganda, the Bolshevists, the Reds, force their way into the city and they beat down all opposition. And building by building, they would take control of all the government offices. And they mercilessly eradicated all that stood in their way. Trotsky made a really good, it was a silent movie back then, but a really good propaganda movie that showed all the Russians shooting and seizing power and doing all the violent revolutionary stuff. Although, do you want to know what the revolution amounted to? They went into where all the government offices were, and the doors were left wide open. They walked into the offices, and they sat down at the desks. That was about it. The only military force that was left on November 7th was a unit of women soldiers that was guarding the palace. When the Bolshevists showed up, the women tried keeping them out. But when the Bolshevists basically said, look, we are going to rape you and then we're going to shoot you, the women pretty much said, okay, go ahead. And they surrendered. But propaganda versus real history. So Lenin takes control. And he proclaims the creation of what he called a Soviet democracy. Lenin would then order the arrest of the Tsar and his family, and they were massacred on the countryside. They were told that they were going to be evacuated to a series of safe houses for their own protection And then they got the family down in the basement, told the family they had to pose for a picture, just so that way they could be proven to still be alive. But as the family was setting up for the pictures, they didn't realize that all the photographers had submachine guns. And they went, and shot them all. Dug a hole outside the building, a shallow grave, threw their bodies in, lit it on fire, and covered them up. The remains were found about, I think, 10 years ago. And then they were given proper burial. But I use that as an example of the type of government that Lenin had his intentions on creating. That's what the Soviet Union was all about. But 3 weeks later, he begins negotiating with Germany. And lo and behold, he gets Russia out of the war by signing the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Brest-Litovsk were two towns that were close to one another. And that's just where the German delegation met with the Soviet delegation. Right there. I think it's actually in modern Poland right now. Might be Belarus, I'm not sure. But anyways, this orange is where the front was when Lenin took over. You can see they had gotten far. But under the treaty, Lenin basically says, all right, you can take Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, you could take a good chunk of Poland, you could take the Ukraine, you could take the Crimea, you get all that. So the purple line, that is the line of the boundary. You take that and the war's over. But of course, the problem with that was, you can't see the stats, but this encompassed 25% of the Russian population. This is where 25% of the Russian railroads were. This is where 35% of the food production came from. This is where 70% of the factories were. And 26% of the iron and steel production. So by giving that land away, Lenin finally got Russia out of the war, but at a tremendous cost. But then Russia got no break. Because within months of ending Russia's involvement in the First World War, a civil war erupted in Russia between the people that wanted to get rid of the Reds, known as the Whites, and the Reds who wanted to get rid of the Whites. This was one of the most deadly civil wars in human history. On top of the millions of Russians that had died in World War I, million more would die in the Russian Civil War. But in the end, the Reds won, and they would create the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, who saw it from 1918 all the way up until 1990. Is that when the Berlin Wall fell, right? 1990, I think, 1992, 91. For almost the entire 20th century, the purpose of the Soviet Union was to spread socialism globally on top of capitalism. They're responsible for the creation of communist China, communist Vietnam, Cuba, and so many other countries. Questions? Alrighty then. Oh, we're done with this little sign now. Let's get back to the war, because we've got to end the war. Because by the time the Russian Civil War erupted, World War I was coming to an end. Ironically, what paved the way for the First World War to end was the Kaiser would abdicate. Why would he abdicate? Well, to be honest with you, he was basically told by his general staff Germany could continue to fight for one more year. That's all they had left. They had enough young men that they could have done one more draft. They could have filled their ranks. They could have had millions of men in the field. But after 1919, they were done. So, because Germany had basically won the East, they had all that land with Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and their troops were still in France, the Kaiser was advised to abdicate and will negotiate. Because after all, technically they're winning. They haven't won yet, but they are winning. So if you're going to negotiate, you negotiate from a position of strength. Then, 2 days later, Armistice Day occurs. On the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month. As New York Times reporter Philip Gibbs reported, last night, for the first time since August in the first year of the war, there were no lights of gunfire in the sky. There were no sudden stabs of flame through the darkness. There were no spreading glow above black trees where for 4 years of nights, human beings were smashed to death. The fires of hell had been put out. War was paused. What's armistice? Is armistice surrender?
It's like a ceasefire.
It's a ceasefire. It's not like a ceasefire, it is a ceasefire. Ceasefire was achieved because Germany had been trying to negotiate with the Allies, and the Allies gave them a list of terms. And Germany accepted it. You have to remember the terms? No, but I'm going to read them anyways. Because maybe you listen to the recordings and you want to know what the details are. Maybe it's in your book. Pretty much, Germany had to withdraw completely on the west. So they had to pull out of France and Belgium, Alsace and Lorraine. That's where they were on November 11th. Well, they had to pull all the way back into Germany. They also had to turn over their entire navy. Both their surface fleet, so their battleships, their destroyers, their cruisers, and their Unterseeboats, their submarines. They also had to give up their artillery, their railroads, etc. They also had to give up all prisoners of war. They had to allow Allied soldiers to actually come into Germany and occupy the border regions of Germany, which, by the way, an Allied soldier hadn't set foot in Germany since like the fall of 1914, when France actually attempted to invade Germany, but the Germans drove them out. So in other words, all of the lands that Germany had, they had to give it all up. And then if that wasn't bad enough, they had to give up the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. So not only did they have to give up all the lands they had in the West, they also had to give up the wind in the East. Now, here is the irony. Germany was, in fact, not defeated. They still had armies in the field. They still had munitions. They still had guns. They still had fuel. But, as the German general staff had noted, the walls were closing in. Because during the end of the summer of 1918, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was knocked out of the war. And then in early October, the Ottoman Empire was knocked out of the war, as was Bulgaria. So essentially, even though Germany knocked Russia out of the war, all that was left was Germany. And Germany knew it could not fight against the French, the British, and everybody else. So why didn't they fight to the end? Well, very simple. The president of these United States of America, Woodrow Wilson, offered Germany an olive branch. Wilson would give public speeches that would be broadcast across the world. Basically, Woodrow Wilson said, and I quote, "We have no jealousy of German greatness. We grudge her no achievement of learning or of pacific enterprise. Such have made her record very bright and very enviable. We do not wish to injure her or to block in any way her legitimate influence of power. We do not wish to fight her, either with arms or with hostile arrangements of trade. If she is willing to associate with us and other peace-loving nations of the world in covenants of justice and law and fair dealing, we only wish her to accept the place of equality among the peoples of the world, the new world in which we live." Wilson is telling Germany, look, if we can just stop the war, we will not punish you. And Germany believed it. The most clearest outlines of what Woodrow Wilson envisioned for the post-World War can be seen in a document known as his 14 points. On January 8, 1918, the president appeared before a joint session of Congress, and he gave a speech in which he laid out these 14 points. The most important ones are the first 5 points. He says there should be an open peace. He says there should be free use of the seas. He calls for free trade. He calls for arms reductions. And he talks about just colonial claims. The key was when he said, he insisted that there should be peace without victory. And how would this be achieved? Well, he called for the creation of the first World Forum. And I'm going to write it because I don't remember what's up here. Known as the League of Nations. So, the next time nations have conflict, they're not going to go to war, but rather they're going to send diplomats, and they're going to gather, and they're going to present their claim in front of all of the other nations, and then democratically, the nations are going to vote and decide whether or not the claim is just or not. And if the claim is just, we'll negotiate. We'll have treaties. We'll have agreements. No more war. The problem was, Wilson wasn't a dictator. And Wilson wasn't fighting an American war. By the time the United States came in 1914, again, we were not the superpower. We were just a great power. But who were the superpowers? England, France. They had been fighting the war for 4 years. Do you think they cared about this pie in the sky, peace without victory? Heck no. Because in order to get anything done, all of the winners would negotiate the outcome. And you know how many votes Woodrow Wilson got? One. So what type of attitudes were you going against? Well, give you the example of the Italian Prime Minister, Vittorio Orlando. As I said last class, Italy, which was originally Germany and Austria's ally, declared neutrality because it was Austria who declared war. It wasn't a defensive war. Italy only came in after England and France promised it stuff. So when the war's over and Orlando shows up to Paris, he's like, where's my stuff? I want land. I want territory. I want cities. Well, when it became clear that he was not going to get what he wanted, he literally got on a train and went back to Italy. He was like a spoiled little kid, taking my ball and I'm going home. Even more significant was British Prime Minister David Lloyd George. Lloyd George famously said when getting on a plane to fly across the English Channel to go to Paris to make the peace negotiations, he was asked by a reporter, Mr. Prime Minister, what is your goals at this peace conference? And he famously said, and I love this line, I intend to squeeze the German lemon until the pips are squeaked. Like if you've ever made lemonade or orange juice. You cut the fruit in half, you put it in the juicer, and you squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze until nothing is left. Why? What did he want? He wanted all of Germany's African colonies, and he wanted the destruction of the Kaiser's fleet. And then if that was not enough to be against the peace without victory, the worst was the old man, as he was known, French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau. Clemenceau was not amused by President Wilson. Not at all. In fact, he famously snarked, Mr. Wilson bores me with his 14 points. Why? Well, God Almighty only has 10. What did he want? Reparations, restitution, and alliances. Reparations, restitution, alliances. In other words, he wanted to do to Germany what Bismarck did to France. So here you have this wonderful Protestant, you know, presidential slash minister basically saying all these high in the sky, almighty, great ideas, the war to end all world wars, you know, we're going to have this peace without victory, self-determination, all this stuff. And the people that's part of his negotiation team are like, hell no. And you know why they were able to do it? Because unlike most of the people in our country, they actually knew how our political system operates. I'll do this quick because I know I'm almost out of time. Every 2 years, there's an election called a midterm election. And when those midterm elections occur, all of the House of Representatives and one-third of the Senate comes up for re-election. Every 4 years, those elections overlap with the presidential election. 1916, when Woodrow Wilson was campaigning for re-election, he promised to keep America out of the war. But literally 2 weeks after he took the oath of office for his second term, he declared war. So, Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, would be hammered like the Democrats hammered Trump or like the Republicans hammered Biden. The Republicans hammered Wilson, basically saying, you're a liar. and they took control of Congress in the midterm elections of 1918. So the President of the United States does not have control with his party over Congress. In order for the United States to get in any type of treaty, it has to be confirmed by the Senate by a two-thirds majority. And the Republicans controlled the Senate, and the Republican leader, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., hated Woodrow Wilson. So the Allies knew. The 14 points are never going to happen because Wilson can't even get it in his own house. So what would happen? Well, we're going to see the Treaty of Versailles when we come back on Tuesday. Now, just as a reminder, we have a full class on Tuesday, and then you have your final exam on the following Tuesday. Are you guys the 10:30 or the 12? I forget. 12:15. All right, so you're the second exam. It is a paper exam. It is not an open note. It is not open electronics. You will sit here and take an old-fashioned exam. So if you've missed any classes, I record all the classes, all the lectures are online. We'll find someone in class that has the notes, and you're going to have to start studying. Final exam counts as 35% of your final hour. Any other questions? Have a good weekend. I'll see you on Tuesday.